From deep inside Death Star, welcome back to Defrag. I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And let's get started today. So on the last show, we had a couple of comments in the show notes. One from Briped that said, with regard to the auto login on PC, the functionality is built in, no need for extra tools. It's the advanced user accounts control panel, which is hidden. So it must be started with the command, just type in control. Yeah. So, and there's a full guide that he links to. I'll link to that in the show notes too. So why not use that one?
I preferred to keep it simple.
Yeah.
I mean, I've used the sysinternals tool for a while. It's just kind of part of the repertoire.
Yeah.
Of course, yes, it uses the same Windows functions that as iControl panel does.
Yeah.
But you know, instead of having to dig around for it, remember the command line. Hey, I just run auto log on. And then
yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah. So, you know, we always talk before the show, and there's, you know, a lot of ways to do different things.
Oh, absolutely.
And sometimes you choose your favorite. Sometimes you there's some reasonings there. But, yeah, you can do that way, too, and we'll link to the thing. And thanks for keeping us honest, our viewers, crowdsourcing tech support.
There's, like, you know, definitely UI ways of doing something. And, you know, if I want to ever add myself to the admin group, I'll never do it through the UI.
Yeah.
Why? Because I can drop down to a command window and do net local group administrators, my username, add, and done. It's really super fast for me. Says it completes successfully, I'm done.
But you're not going to tell, you know, grandma.
No. Well, maybe.
Your grandma, maybe.
No, actually, I would never actually set her up as an admin. I'd keep her as a standard user.
Yeah.
So I'd never have to worry about that.
Yeah.
I'd give her the computer first.
Yeah.
And it's like, here, it's pre-configured. Don't touch anything.
Yeah.
Here's the email.
Turn it on. So we got another one from Magic Andre 1981. Andre, what's up, my buddy? Is it possible to shrink the size of Windows XS folder? He said, yes, if you install Windows 7 SP1, you run this, dism.exe/online/cleanup image/supersede/remove/other RTM files. So,
yep, and in the exact inverse of what I just mentioned about dropping to a command line and doing something, that's exactly what the disk cleanup wizard does.
Yeah.
Of course, but it's only useful if you've installed SP1.
Yeah.
It doesn't help any of the other applications that might have been installed that also added to the SXS folder.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, so let's get to our first question today. So the first one's kind of a simple one. It's one of those forehead slappers that you're like, oh. I know that the WinKey+M and WinKey+D will essentially minimize all windows and show me the desktop. How do I get to the windows to restore, they're asking.
Okay, so
the
desktop.
Windows D? Windows D again. You just got to hit it again.
It's
one of those ones where, oh, I should have known.
Well, it kind of makes sense, right? Because in all the documentation, it just says minimize to desktop.
Yeah, and if you minimize everything desktop, what's it supposed to do if you hit it again?
Right.
So, yeah. It's just one
Our documentation could be better.
Well, yeah. I know the people write the documentation. It's tough.
Well, no, because our documentation can always improve. It doesn't matter how good it is. It can always be better.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so next question. I need to make Windows use my two monitors as one. End result is that any full-screen software would see the resolution as an entirety of the two monitors. The idea here being programs that require full-screen and to bind one monitor use two without complaining. Surely there's software drivers for this. If it's any help, it's onboard ATI card, and the ATI software for this doesn't function quite as expected with full-screen applications. Windows programs stretch fine, but videos, games, virtual machines all continue to use just the one. So here's the thing with this. There is a way to do this, and they mentioned that they have an ATI card. The technology for this for ATI is called iFinity.
Okay.
And we can bring up the site for that. This will take all of your monitors and bind them into, like, one monitor. Now, there's a lot of
So who makes this?
This is ATI's technology, and NVIDIA has a similar technology, and I can't remember off the top of my head what it's called.
Okay.
There's some pretty significant caveats with this. The first being that, like, this laptop has iFinity. It's iFinity capable. And it's got three outputs. So I've got VGA, I've got HDMI, and I've got a DisplayPort.
Okay.
To use iFinity, one of the monitors, the first monitor that I hook up, has to be DisplayPort. Now, that means the monitor has to have a DisplayPort input on it. And I've tried using an adapter, and they have a list of, you know, here's some adapters you can use to adapt your DisplayPort to HDMI.
Mm-hmm.
None of them have worked for me. And I've actually bought you know, some of the ones that they suggested. So I do have a monitor, though, that has a DisplayPort input, and if I take the mini DisplayPort from the laptop and plug into that monitor, no problem. I can bind all the monitors as one, and that's pretty nice, because if you're running a game, it'll allow you to have the game across all the monitors instead
of one. That immersive experience.
Yeah, and even with a web browser, yeah, you can stretch a web browser across multiple monitors, mm-hmm. but if you, like, maximize it, it doesn't maximize across all of them. So it's, you know, not exactly the same thing. Now, the thing with iFinity, though, is you have to have an ATI card that supports iFinity, and unfortunately, they don't all. And even some of the later models, I have a later model ATI card in my machine at home, and it doesn't have iFinity. So you want to check that, check the site, make sure your card supports it, and then make sure you go through the hoops of, like, having the right kinds of monitors and things like that if this is something that you want to do.
Any other pitfalls, performance?
Well, I will say this. I mean, this is an HP Envy 17, maxed out. I mean, it has got SSD. It's got all the RAM that I could stick in it. And I tried to run Dirt. And there's a YouTube video. If you go search HP Envy, 17 iFinity on YouTube, mm-hmm. there's a cool video of them playing Dirt. And, you know, they're across all the monitors, and it just looks awesome. And that was what inspired me to want to try that out. But the perf on this, I was running Just Cause 2, which maybe it's a more demanding game, mm-hmm. but I was trying to do Just Cause 2 across three monitors, which, by the way, looked awesome, because I was using three 42-inch monitors.
Yeah, those aren't monitors, man. Those are TVs.
Yeah, so it was like sitting in an IMAX playing Just Cause 2, but I'm doing, like, you know, I don't know, 6,000 by, you know, 1,200 or something. And the performance on Just Cause 2 was not enough with this laptop to make me want to sit down and play that game for an extended period of time.
Do you know if the iFinity can be used in a Crossfire configuration? So if you had, like, say, a desktop system that had multiple ATI cards, do you think that would be possible?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I would love to try it. This is why we need a budget to try some of these things out.
That would be a hardware config TVs. That I would love.
Yeah, yeah. We'll
I mean, look at this picture right here. Was that six monitors or two and four?
What's going on
I can't
there?
Exactly
it's a, it's
see
a lot
it.
Of monitor.
It's a lot of monitor. And it's, imagine, you know, I would love Flight Sim on this or, you know, any of the first-person shooters being, you know, totally immersed in that environment. I've got a TV at home that's 96 inches, projector system, but it's not quite immersive in that same respect. Like, you don't have the super high resolution in that particular configuration.
Yeah, so I use Crossfire, two ATI cards in Crossfire at home on my home PC, mm-hmm. But because they don't support iFinity, the cards that I have, mm-hmm. You know, I can't do more than two monitors. I'm kind of stuck for two monitors and doing, you know, a good game. And Flight Sim X, you know, that's the one that I'm using that for the most, and it's awesome. I think Flight Sim, though, would be better with three monitors than two, because with two monitors, I've got the bezel
right
in the middle of my field of view, mm-hmm. but with three, you know, you could have your front view and your side views. So I'm striving for that. My next video card, I'm going to make sure it does iFinity. I'm going to make sure that I can support three monitors, because I have to. I have to do this. And we have to find some budget for this.
Some
sponsors. This show brought to you by AMT ATI iFinity. Awesome. All right. So next question. Is it possible to force a certain external USB drive to use the same drive letter when switching computers? Any tricks to allow this behavior?
There is, but it's a little bit manual, so to speak. What you'd have to do on each computer is, what I did was just right-click computer, go to manage, bringing up the disk management wizard.
Yeah.
There are different ways of doing it. I find this is the easiest through the UI.
You know, when I click on disk management like this, mm-hmm. why does it take so long to populate here?
So it's,
and I have a lot of drives at home, so I suspect that's probably part of the
problem.
It is
scanning all of those drives. It's getting information about those drives. It's having to load up the virtual disk management service in order to get all the information that is needed.
So having the 10 USB drives on it probably isn't helping me out
when
I go in there.
No, not at all. I don't have a particular USB drive attached to this right now, but you can kind of do it basically with anything. If you have the USB drive plugged in, you just right-click on it, say, change drive letter and paths. You know, you can change it to a different drive letter, you know, if I wanted it as L.
I put all my CD drives as like X, Y, and Z
mm-hmm.
because I want them, I don't want to see far. Them far away. And then I have like movies under M, mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. Or
yeah.
Music under M, movies under something else.
Probably V.
I have at home.
Video.
Yeah, videos.
Or T for TV.
Yeah.
But you do this, you assign the drive letter to the drive, and if you do that on each of the machines that you want that drive to be on, it will persist that drive letter
sticky.
For that.
So it's sticky. So if I have a thumb drive,
it is sticky, but not sticky on the thumb drive itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's sticky per the machine.
So if you set it up on all your machines as you go around, you're going to get the same drive. And that's probably a good thing, because then you always know my little, like I got a USB thumb drive that I use, that's always going to be like you or whatever drive you're used to, and you can remember that.
Although for myself, you know, if it's just pictures or something on it, I don't usually care about the drive letter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're actually, say, using the USB stick with an application and you're redirecting information to that USB stick, so, you know, you have the application installed on multiple machines, you have it configured in a particular way, you plug in the USB stick, you do your work with it,
yeah.
That is where things like that can get very very useful and be very confusing to the application if it gets a different drive letter.
Excellent. All right, next question. I like using Start plus typing a name to launch apps, but sometimes apps don't launch. For instance, when I type iTunes and I hit enter, it brings up the About iTunes Terms of Service and not the app. How can I fix that?
So I have a different example, same problem. I don't have iTunes installed on this machine, but I use PowerShell a lot. So if I type in Power, I actually get PowerPoint.
Yeah.
I don't want PowerPoint, I want PowerShell. And the reason this comes up is because it's alphabetical. So
yeah.
the M is first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you'd potentially want to do is you could prefix this with like Z underscore, you know, change the shortcut to it. In the iTunes case where it says About iTunes, it was just pointing to an RTF file.
Yeah.
You could just delete that.
Yeah.
Or again, since it was A for About iTunes, you can prefix it with Z underscore and then mm-hmm. have
or
it.
Or Z, if you're not Canadian.
Yeah, sorry. That Z's the right way.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
I can you know, pander to the to
who's
the Americans.
Zed? Who's Zed?
You know, Zed Zed Top?
Yeah, there's a segment of America that's going, who's Zed? Okay, so, yeah, we tested this out on iTunes, and you can just delete the iTunes icon, or you can...
Or the About iTunes.
Yeah, the About iTunes.
If you delete the iTunes icon, you're not getting iTunes.
Or you can delete the iTunes icon. All right, next question. I recently got a Silicon Dust HD Home Run Prime. When I use a test application, it comes with hardware. I can view and hear TV streams fine in 5-channel. When I use Media Center to view the TV, I get an error. This also happens with DVDs that want to output to more than 2 channels. Note that Windows Media Player works totally fine with both sources, DVDs and TV stream, or 5.1 greater channel input. I found that if my sound setup in Windows is set for stereo 2 channels, this works fine. I can see and hear the video. If it's set up for 5.1 audio in the Media Center only, I cannot see or hear, and I get a video codec error message. I have eliminated in my diagnostics codecs, hardware drivers, and other potential sources.
So this one actually took a lot more going back and forth about the configuration. But in the end, they just hooked up HDMI,
yeah.
And he'd turned on auto volume leveling in Media Center.
Yeah.
That will start restricting because Media Center will have to do the processing now.
Yeah.
I have the virtually identical setup at home,
mm-hmm.
And I've kind of bypassed this entire problem altogether by setting my sound to be SPDIF optical.
Yeah.
So I don't use the audio channel off of HDMI at all, and I just have the optical going to my receiver and having it do all the work.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might not seem as elegant, you know, you have 2 cables coming out of your system versus just the one through HDMI, but
mm-hmm.
Mine works,
yeah,
and I don't have to worry about it.
There is that difference. Yeah, I had a problem over the weekend where my kids tried to watch a DVD in the Xbox, and
mm-hmm.
The sound was all garbled, and it took me a few minutes. I was like, what's going on? Why can't I hear this DVD? And I had the volume all the way up, and it just sounded horrible. And it turned out the TV that I was running the HDMI to has 2 speakers, and the Xbox was set up for 5.1. And the funny thing is I did a search online, and there were a lot of people who experienced this, and they couldn't figure it out, and they really didn't have any good answers for it. But it was just one of those things where I was like, oh, let me just go and check. audio, and it turned out it was 5.1. So that was another one where...
That's interesting. You know, TVs being, you know, two-speaker output, so stereo output only.
Yeah.
It seemed like it would make a lot of sense because I know this is possible. Even in a two-speaker configuration, you can emulate a 5.1 configuration.
Yeah.
You know, Bose does this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's other software methods of emulating it, or at least telling the source system, yeah, in fact, it is 5.1. The TV should be smart enough to say, you know what, if I get 5.1, I'll change it on the fly to 2, or I'll emulate it on my own and not screw up the sound.
Yeah.
You know, because as you say, this is not user-friendly. This is not remotely customer-friendly. And if you're just sticking in an HDMI cable, you kind of expect that it should work.
Yeah. Now, that said, these were old TVs, so I'm going to give them a pass. They're old Westinghouse, like, you know, old LCDs. And so, I'll give them a pass.
Well, it has HDMI, so how old could it be?
Yeah, it has HDMI, so come on. Figure it out. All right, next question. I've got matched multi-monitor set up with a laptop at work and at home. When switching between them, Windows 7 changes the layout of my desk icons. Is there a way to prevent this?
Do you want the long, complicated answer?
I want to hear both. I know you've got a short one. I suspect what it's going to be.
The long, complicated answer is no.
Okay, so that's the long and the short one.
That's the long and the short one.
So, known issue, not going to get a fix anytime soon.
No, because you're changing resolutions all the time, we don't know what the proper icons are supposed to be. All we want to do is make sure that the icons are being displayed.
Yeah.
We don't want them lost.
Sure
we don't want
them,
you know, off on a different screen somewhere or pushed off. We just want to get them back onto whatever visible desktop that the user can see.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, if you have that kind of problem where it's, you know, jumbled up all the time, mm-hmm. what I do is I take all those shortcuts, put it into a folder, put the folder on the desktop, and just kind of eliminate the problem that way. But I do a lot of working around the issue.
Yeah,
you know, if the OS, if the application is not doing exactly what I want it to do, and if I can't fix it myself, I'll just work around it in a different way and just kind of get used to it.
Nice. Good. All right, next question. While I like that my company is conserving energy with the non-peak power plan, when I'm copying large multi-gig files overnight, VHDs, it's very frustrating that instead of continuing to work through the night, after 1 hour the PC is put to sleep. Is there any way around this with Windows 7 to defer, prevent the sleep?
Yeah, I just turn it off for the duration of the operation, and you can do that by going to the power profile, more power options. It'll be, you know, balanced,
mm-hmm.
change when the computer sleeps, and, you know, when plugged in, you just say never.
Yeah. So if this is a group policy, it's being pushed on you from elsewhere.
If it's a group policy, then you're going to want to inform your IT department that perhaps you can be under a different power plan, you mm-hmm. know, and subscribe to that power plan. Or be exempted entirely from it.
Yeah, we have a system like that here at Microsoft. Some of our studio machines, if we're rendering with them, we don't want them to get put to sleep.
Right.
So yeah, you contact your admin.
There are also other hacky solutions if you you know, desperately wanted to do that by simulating a user being present at the computer.
A little mouse wiggle here and there.
There are tons of third-party applications that. That will do that for you and will defer the sleep by making the computer think that you're physically present.
Cool. Okay. All right. Next question. This one's kind of interesting. When I insert a smart card to a card reader and plug it into my PC at home, after arriving at the office, I connect to this home PC via RDP, and I want to connect to a web ATM by the smart card. However, the web ATM always says it cannot detect any card reader. Is this a by-design behavior? Am I correct? So this was interesting. So they're hooking up a card reader and a smart card on their PC at home.
Right.
They're going to work.
Yep.
They're RDPing into their home machine.
Yep.
And then they're trying to connect securely to a network using their card reader. And it doesn't detect that the card reader is connected to that machine.
Right.
Tell us what's going on here.
So, yeah, that is actually by design. The remote desktop protocol has the ability to take or redirect the smart card attached to the host machine.
Yeah,
and redirect it to your target machine, the one that you're remote desktoping into.
So they can still do this.
Yes, but they need to have the card and reader physically present with them.
And that's the security aspect
that's
of
the
it,
security
is that
aspect.
There is a physical card, and there's a person who knows the password.
Yeah.
And so if those are at your house, or if one or the other is at your house, that's not the way that's supposed to work.
Right.
So just plug your card reader and your card into the machine that you're using, mm-hmm. RDP into your home machine, and it passes through?
Yes.
Awesome. I did not know that.
Unless you desperately needed something that was only available on your home machine, of course, you just dispense with the remote desktop altogether and just connect to the web bank account directly from that machine.
Very cool. Awesome. Okay. All right, next question. What is the right directory to recommend application developers to write local temporary user data in? And they suggested a couple. One was ctemp, and that's really old school.
The ctemp directory, definitely never write any data there whatsoever. Don't create it. Don't write to it. No, that's definitely not
the right
place. I
prefer nobody ever make any root directories off my C drive.
That is absolutely, absolutely true. You know, if you have an application installing persistent, per machine, non-writable data should go into the program files directory. If it's shareable data that is across multiple users, it should go into the program data directory, anything mm-hmm. that's writable, program data, their application, create a subdirectory off of that. If it's temporary user data, we have a directory that already exists for users. It's the user temp directory. We can go there by just typing temp. So I have a lot of temp.
And so an application developer shouldn't just write to that root directory either, right?
Right. They ideally, what you want to do is, if it's really temporary data, right? So every time your application starts, you want to have an area just to write temp data. When the application shuts down, you don't care about the data anymore. What you want to do is, from the temp directory, create another temporary folder, random generated folder name, you know, to keep it, you know, very, very volatile.
Yeah.
Then you save that information.
So should you name it after the name of the application so that the user, if they go in there, they might know what that's coming from?
You could. You could, prefix it with something and then...
Because it's unlikely someone else is going to use your application name as a temporary...
Depends on what the application is. It depends on what kind of data is being stored there, because you don't also want to have something that's easily squattable or predictable.
Yeah.
But it kind of all depends, right? You just don't want collisions is really what you're looking for. If your application, you can run multiple times, you may or may not want to have that data intersect with each other, depending on what
you're
throwing.
So you might have a new random directory every time. Interesting. Okay.
And, cool. I mean, that's what I would do, and that's what a lot of applications do. As you can tell, I have a lot of temporary directories created based on, some app that was running. I believe with Div, something it had to do with DivX. So I ran that on here a few times.
Yeah, last week.
And what you can do is, if you're properly designing the app and you're kind of worried about, well, I don't want to have folders kicking around all the time, if my app crashes or whatever. Well, at the beginning, if you've prefixed it with something and you know that there's a particular pattern to your folders, mm-hmm. you can say, well, one already exists, I can potentially use that one, or I can say, no, I'm going to create a new one and then clean out any older ones that are there. I can look for data, look for markers that say, yep, this is my directory, but it's, orphaned. I want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You can put all those smarts into it, but the user temp directory is definitely where temp data per user should go, not shareable across users, and kept very volatile.
Yeah.
Don't rely on the data there. You can have some self-consistency checks and say, it doesn't quite look right. Fine, blow it away, create a new one, start from scratch.
Awesome. Okay. All right, next question. We can't set a folder name that starts with .dot by Windows Explorer. I tested this phenomenon. It prompts you must type a file name. I'd like to know if there's a rule or anything that talks about this. Okay. Of course there is.
Oh, there's always a rule for something. So they wanted to create a new folder with .dot. Something. You must type a file name.
And the person thinks I did type a file name, .jdh.
Right. The issue is that we detect that as an extension without a file name. Now, they were able to do something like space dot, you know, and that actually works.
Yeah.
And you might, you know, wonder, well, yeah, it still was a leading dot, so why does that work? Well, because it's no longer, we're no longer looking at it as an extension.
Yeah.
Because there's a space in it. So you can't have spaces in extensions. Mm-hmm. So we say, oh, it's not an extension anymore. Let's kick out that rule, and then we'll name it as a folder. So there's a lot of, wouldn't necessarily call them heuristics, but, you know, parsing rules to say, okay, it doesn't look like this anymore. Let's kick it out. Let's apply a different rule to it. And then that particular rule applied. Raymond Chen, I believe I've mentioned him before on the show. He's, mm-hmm. well, one of my many idols here at Microsoft.
He's yeah.
truly brilliant. Individual. He has a blog, The Old New Thing, and there's a lot of questions that come up, and it's amazing at how, you know, not just has he an article on it, but the article was written a while ago. You know, I can understand yeah. things where it's like the question just came in and, you know, he writes an article on it. Mm-hmm. No. He's got like an article for a vast, vast number of problems that people have had, and they may not have even asked about it. Like he'll just come up with these articles.
Yeah.
They're a great source of information, and he has an article that's devoted to this.
Very cool.
So yeah, you know, I highly recommend you check out Raymond's blog. A lot of funny stories there. A lot of stories that'll make you cry,
yeah,
or give you a headache. You know, yeah. you kind of have the whole emotional range reading Raymond's blog.
Yeah,
but I recommend it. It's a good read. He also has a book, The Old New Thing. He took a collection of his best articles and put it into a book. I have it. It's a great book. It's a
Very
great read.
Cool. Awesome. All right, next question. Can I use a product key from Retail Box to upgrade Windows 7 Starter to Ultimate on a netbook?
Yes.
Yeah, so the process for that, you can use anytime upgrade.
Right.
And you can do that anytime. You don't have to go to a big box store.
Oddly enough, so the search box does not know anything about anytime, but if you actually know where to look for it, it's under properties, and I believe I've got... so my system's not a retail box, unfortunately, but
yeah.
Anytime upgrade would be on this section of the screen,
yeah,
on the properties of the computer. If you're running Home Premium, Starter, Basic, whatever, you know, they'll say upgrade now, mm-hmm. and you can click on that button.
Yeah, I've done that at home, and it's very nice. It's a great way to upgrade your machine.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so next question. Is it possible to configure Wi-Fi so it will only connect to a corporate network, no hotspot connectivity?
Yes, there are group policies that that will dictate that. It's the 802.11x policy, I believe it is.
Yeah, IEEE 802.11 policies, wireless networks.
And, I mean, for the home user, you will never use this. This is really for the enterprise where they want to make sure that, you know, they can't connect outside of their own corporate wireless network.
Yeah.
You know, it's for high security kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
They want to make sure that they're going through their firewalls, that you know, you can't get snooped by other Wi-Fis.
Yeah, awesome. All right, pick of the week time. So this is your pick of the week. Instructables.
This is my pick of the week. There's this website. I'm sure many of you know about it. It's Instructables.com. If nothing, this is an idea generator.
Yeah.
You know, you see things, it's like, oh, you know, I had a similar idea about that, and, like, how did somebody build it? This is the ultimate physical hacker site.
And
they talk
love,
about a whole bunch of stuff here.
I love the page you picked.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
I like the page that I picked. this is kind of random. You know, I was just flipping through it, went to the technology section and computer section, and I saw this Wi-Fi extender.
Yeah.
Super, super basic, but you look at it and it's like, that's just the essence of simplicity right there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us have USB Wi-Fi dongles. I have them at home because I want to leverage the 5 gigahertz A-band.
Yeah.
And not a lot of laptops, so some of the older ones only went B, G, and N, not A, B, G, and N.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got one of these, and it is so simple to set up an extender. I mean, they used a USB dongle and what looks to be...
It's like a strainer. My grandma had one of those.
Right. So this is a steamer plate, so for, I guess, for vegetables.
I didn't know my grandma had Wi-Fi problems, but apparently she bought it because she did. Now, I wonder if this is actually like a real parabolic arc, or if you could hammer it a little bit to get it to fit right.
I'm sure you could find many parabolic style dishes.
Yeah.
You know, you could use a colander, you could use, you know, almost
just a metal bowl.
Any metal bowl, really.
Bore out a hole in the bottom.
Yep.
Very interesting. So I wonder how big a difference. Did they do any kind of metrics here to tell what the difference is with and without it?
Oh, let's take a look. I don't think there's a lot of steps.
And it'd be a good place to try use some Sugru, too. You can use some Sugru on the back to stick your cable through there. So you got two picks of the week that you could use together.
Yeah, I mean, what they talk about on the site is, you know, just using household materials, really cheap materials, just MacGyvering something together.
And it looks really cool. It looks like the kind of thing that, you know, some Delta Force team is going to go set up out in the middle of nowhere.
So one of those fanning out satellite dishes. Yeah. I don't know.
All right. Well, again, we need a budget so that we can do our own testing.
Well, that's just it for this one. I mean, you need hardly any budget.
Yeah. Shh. Gotta tell Dan we need some budget. Awesome. So that's the pick of the week for this week, and that's our show. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and we'll see you next week.